Welcome to the Painting Lines Podcast, your one-stop shop for all things tennis. Join Eric and Aiden in their discussion for updates on news and pop culture, and from hot takes to betting, they've got you covered.
Ready? Set.
Welcome back to Painting Lines. Last week we discussed the Shanghai Open and its shocking winner, and this week we're going to be discussing the three tournaments that were going on this past week in Japan, Sweden, and Belgium. So just kicking things off, we had the Japan Open. I don't think anybody really saw Ben Shelton winning it, and I just think it's funny because a couple of weeks ago I saw an article and I brought it up on the pod that was like, Shelton's one of the next guys that's going to win a tournament. And I was like, I don't see him winning a tournament for the next 6 months or so. And then 2 weeks later, he wins a tournament. And I'm like, well, I look like an idiot, don't I? But I'm happy to admit I was wrong. This guy is legit.
No, that's good to see. I know. And I feel like a lot of what you say, kind of the opposite happens.
Yeah, it sometimes seems like the exact opposite of what I say happens, but it's just how it goes sometimes.
Can you please say something about Tommy Paul never winning a Grand Slam?
Yeah, exactly.
I would love to see that.
Yeah, I mean, he was just playing with so much confidence in this tournament. Even beat Tommy Paul again, second time this year. So really a great result. His ranking goes up to number 15 in the world.
Yeah, that's got to feel weird for Tommy Paul, because remember that article that I talked about last week where they kind of referred to him as the veteran, and he said that Ben Shelton was not like his little brother, but kind of like an equal who brought more attention and more kind of flair to the tour, and now he's beaten him twice.
Yeah, and they're like a very similar ranking now.
Yeah, no, I know. And not to say Ben Shelton doesn't deserve it, but he is so new to the tour, whereas Tommy Paul has been on the tour since he was 17.
Yeah.
It's like they're pretty much equal right now.
Exactly. Exactly.
Crazy how tennis works. But yeah, another thing about Ben Shelton I noticed too in the final was his composure. Like, you know how he loves to celebrate, he loves to scream. I felt like he was stone cold in that final. Like when he was celebrate, it would be mostly just a stare down or like a fist bump. It wasn't like his usual, yeah.
He also debuted that new celebration. Do you see it with the, he did that classic like straightening the tie celebration. And he's like, no, no, now it's all business.
Oh, let's go.
It kind of reflects that idea that you were talking about.
Definitely. I know they asked him, how are you going to celebrate your first ATP title victory? And he goes, oh, probably just eat a cheeseburger and pack my bags and go to the next tournament. Someone who's confident, you know, who expects to keep winning, that's how you got to roll.
Exactly. Exactly. No big celebration either, really, when he won the tournament. Like, he just... Yeah. One and just like walked to the net, shook hands, and was like, yeah, I expected it almost.
Hey, I don't know if you got to see Karetsev just smash his racket, go to town on it. That was hilarious. At that point, I knew Ben, and I think Ben knew too that he was basically going to win the match, because as long as he could keep his composure, Karetsev was basically falling apart. And he's 30 years old too.
Yeah.
Probably pissed he was losing to a 21-year-old.
I think he's also pissed because Karetsev's one of those guys where he does have flashes like he did in this tournament where he makes these massive runs and has the ability to get these big results, but they're kind of few and far between. So he also is probably just pissed that like this opportunity to win a tournament that may not come around, at least for a while, is just slipping through his fingers.
I really like that observation because, yeah, basically, like you said, Karatsev's one of those guys where you don't really hear too much about him, but then he does have those flares. So, yeah, he probably won't be in another title for a while.
Exactly. Like you'll see him show up in a tournament and you'll be like, oh, he just beat two top 10 guys this tournament or something. You're like, where'd this guy come from? And then you'll not hear about him again for the next like 3 months. And you're like, oh, what the hell just happened?
Exactly.
Speaking of what we were talking about earlier, I had to bring up the fact that FAA got a couple of wins in this tournament. And it's as though it was just to screw up my bet of the week. I placed no bet of the weeks against FAA pretty much for almost his entire losing streak. And then as soon as I put one against him, he wins his first two matches. But I think it's hilarious. I mean, it's the first time since Indian Wells that he's won two matches in a tournament.
I think it's also hilarious that after each one before that you didn't place the bet, you were like, dude, I was thinking about doing it. I so should have done it.
Exactly. And this is the one you actually exactly. did. Yeah, 100%. But speaking on this, I mean, could it be a positive sign for him? I mean, he did get beaten pretty handedly by Jerome, but
I think it's definitely a positive sign. Like, it's at least it's not a bad sign that he's losing. Like, he's getting these little wins, and when you are in kind of this losing streak that he's in, you need to start stacking small wins and not celebrate them, but definitely build them up to help your confidence. And you know, at least he's going in somewhat the right direction. He's not regressing.
Yeah. I mean, it's like kind of like Shelton, like we were just talking about. He had that long streak this year where he was not playing very well. I mean, I know I was getting a little bit down on him. And then he comes into the US Open. He actually lost his first set at the US Open. And then something flips. He turns it around, gets a win, wins a second round, starts building up these wins. And then since then, he's been doing great in tournaments. And I think, like you were saying, getting those little positive steps can just boost your confidence back up, and you can start playing at the level where you know you can. But when you're on just a losing streak and you just lose every match, there's just a mental thing where you feel like you're going to lose going into the match probably.
Oh, 100%. And I think 2022 FAA would go into the match against Jerome being like, okay, who's up next? You know, because he was lights out. He was ranked number 6.
Exactly. Yeah. Speaking on the rankings, I mean, we're going to see where he kind of ends up this year, but where do you think he belongs? Because to see where you are really for 2023, you can base it on kind of those race to Turin rankings. And in those rankings, FAA is like 50 something.
Aiden, do you think you can kind of go into more detail on, you said about him being ranked 50th? That's a projection.
So the way the race to Turin rankings work is it's just based on your results from 2023.
Got it. So it's calendar rankings.
It's a calendar ranking. Okay. Exactly.
Got it.
So in the calendar rankings, FAA is in the mid 50s. Mm-hmm. Right now.
Got it. Cause right now he's what? 19th.
Yeah. In the current like rolling rankings, he's like 19th or something like that. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, I think he's playing like someone ranked in their 30s, 40s, because you obviously know he has talent and you see little spurts of it, but he just doesn't get these wins. And I feel like that's the kind of player you get with someone who's ranked in the 30s or 40s. Cause heck, they made it all the way down there. It's pretty good ranking, but they're not able to execute.
100%. That's a pretty tough fall to go down into the 40s by the end of this year, probably. Last kind of storyline from this tournament was Mochizuki obviously made a run all the way to the semifinals, but I think the big event was him beating Fritz. And I think, honestly, this match was less about Mochizuki and more about Fritz, because Fritz dominated him in the first set, had a chance to serve for the match, didn't deliver, and ends up losing that second set and then the third. And it kind of seemed like he just choked a little bit. So what do you think about this match? Do you think it was all on Fritz, or do you think it was Mochizuki kind of just playing out of his mind?
Dude, tennis sucks, man. Oh my God. Imagine being Fritz. See, that's just the type of thing that we kind of talked about last week too, where Fritz, before he was expected to be a top 10 player, where he would, you know, have these great wins, but wasn't expected to, I guess, do a whole lot. Now he's kind of at that point where he's got the title as top American. Don't know how much longer he's going to hold that with Shelton, but I don't know. I think it could be a little bit of both. I think obviously if you're serving for the match, then yeah, you blew it. It wasn't like Mochizuki just suddenly played lights out. I mean, not to discredit him, I think he played amazing the whole tournament, but I think that's more on Fritz blowing it than Mochizuki coming back. I mean, he had the crowd on his side. Maybe that had something to do with it.
100%. I think the crowd can definitely impact it, especially when you start to kind of not necessarily choke a match, but you start to kind of tighten up at the end of a match, like Fritz obviously did a little bit. I think the crowd can have a bigger impact because you're really in your own head. And with the crowd being so obviously all for the Japanese guy, Fritz is going to maybe feel that a little bit more and feel a little bit more like the crowd's against him, get a little bit more down on himself. And that could definitely have impacted how the match ended up.
Yeah, this would be really interesting to see, you know, years down the road, if Taylor Fritz were to write a book like Agassi's Open, and he could describe what was going on in his head during that last game of that match, like how he blew it.
Yeah.
Because you have to just completely lose your mind.
Yeah, I think that's why sometimes a cool thing that you'd want to see on a show like Breakpoint is matches like that, where it's not necessarily like a Grand Slam match, but it's a match where the mental component and seeing what was actually going on in the guy's head would actually be an interesting storyline to see.
Yeah, maybe Fritz needs some kind of sports psychologist on his team. Maybe he needs to do more mental work, because he's got the skill, he's got the talent, but he's just not able to finish wins like this.
Yeah.
But Mochizuki was my favorite story of the whole tournament.
100%. I mean, getting a Japanese guy through to the semifinals.
And he was electric, though, to watch. You know, he was all over the court. He was playing very well. Like, not to discredit him at all. He was exciting. He was like a little firecracker running around there. He's a small guy.
Yeah. But moving on to Stockholm, smaller tournament. One of the storylines from the tournament was obviously Runa made the decision to go from Shanghai to Stockholm and then just loses in the first round to Kecmanovic. Makes him fall to 1-6 since Wimbledon. His only win coming over another guy that's struggling, FAA. So I just feel like he's in a tough spot right now. And I wonder whether he's going to be able to hang on to make it to the ATP finals.
Yeah. Well, so the first thing I want to say on this is Kecmanovic is a legitimate player. You know, he's not someone who you would just expect Runa to walk all over. I think Kecmanovic does kind of, he's on a similar level as him, but you know, going back, say 6 months, 8 months, this is someone that Rude should definitely beat, no problem. He also needed to defend his title too. Like, that's why he flew back from Shanghai, to, you know, get back to Sweden and get this thing done.
Yeah, and after being unable to defend his title, he kind of has to try and move on, but he still has to play the same guy in the next tournament. So it's hard to forget it if you're playing the same guy that he just lost to. So I think that's going to be a tough thing to see for him. And we're going to see a very interesting mental battle, I think, for Runa. Either he's going to say, I'm not losing to this guy twice in a row, kind of like what we saw with Safelin versus Zverev a couple weeks ago, where Safelin lost to Zverev in the final at Chengdu and then came back in Shanghai and beat him. Mm-hmm. Is Runa going to lose to Kecmanovic and then say, no, I'm going to step in and assert myself and win this match against this guy? Or is he going to shy away from the moment and lose to him a second time in 2 weeks?
Yeah, I guess only time will tell. But I want to kind of answer your question with a question of my own. How much of Runa versus coaches do you think will be making the adjustments to when he plays Kecmanovic again?
I think that Runa can't depend on his coaches, because only he can really know what's going on in his head.
He's got to execute too. They can tell him these things, but it only matters if he can actually do it.
100%. And the thing is that they know he has the ability to beat someone like Kecmanovic, but the question is whether he can perform at that level. They know he can, or whether his mentality is going to break down and he's just going to lose again.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And I've always wondered, when players play in, not exhibitions, but you know how they'll hit with each other and play live points and it's not part of a real match, I always wonder why they do that, because I feel like you give away a lot of stuff. But then again, when you play these players over and over again on tour, you know, you're not really hiding anything new, are you? There's nothing that anyone hasn't seen before. This could possibly be why Tsitsipas, Rude, FAA, even Runa a little bit, like, aren't, I don't know if it's people are learning how to play them or they're just not playing up to the level that they've been playing before.
Yeah, I think it has to be they're not playing at the level they have in the past, because everybody knows kind of what Alcaraz's game is. People know what Djokovic's game is. They know what Medvedev's game is. But those guys don't lose as often just because they're so good at it. If they're performing on their own game plan and they're playing up to the level they expect from themselves, nobody can really beat them.
Yeah, and it is good. It's fun to see, actually. You know how Alcaraz's game was a lot of drop shots because he's got such nice touch, but that just doesn't work against someone like Medvedev, who covers the whole entire court. And not only does he get there with ease to like get the ball back, but he's got that little flick, kind of like half shot. But I don't know. We'll see how this plays out with those three or four that I mentioned. Hopefully they can get it back to where they've been.
Yeah, Alcaraz just needs a lesson in drop shots from Morojan.
That's where I was getting at. I knew you were going to bring that up. Let's
the
go.
Hungarian headhunter, baby.
Oh my God.
But
What's his deal? Where was he?
I think he lost his next two matches after that tournament. But I mean,
hey, but he's coming.
Exactly. You never know. Like, he could come in and beat Djokovic in Paris. We don't know.
Dude, you better watch out. If you see Mrozhin on your side of the bracket.
Yeah, you're like, dude, this guy might just murder me, but he also might lose in the first round.
I was going to say, well, if you're ranked in the top 10, then you should be worried. If you're not, he probably won't beat you.
Exactly. He plays at the level of his opponent, maybe.
Yeah, it plays up.
But speaking on another storyline from this tournament, Monfils got the title, his first title in a year and a half. Last time he won a tournament was in Adelaide in January of 2022. So pretty big win for him. Moves his ranking up actually back within the top 100. He's number 89 now. And my first thought when I saw that he wins this is like, is he still planning to retire? And what's the timeline for that? Because obviously earlier in the year, he was like, okay, I'm pretty much done. And now he's played a lot better recently, wins a title. What's next for him?
Well, I think that depends. Did he say when he planned on retiring? Was it at the end of the year? Or was it like, hey, I'm going to play one more French Open, one more Roland Garros, and then retire after that? Because that is his home slam.
I think he more just hinted at it. Like, yeah, I'm going to be winding it down. I don't think he ever really said, oh, I'm going to play one more of this. I'm going to play one more of this. Okay. I don't think he ever said anything super definite.
Mm-hmm.
Because
well, in that case,
it's always better, I think, for them to leave it a little bit open. And I think that's what he was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, then I think he's going to keep going. I think that's going to deter his retirement just a little longer because you know how good winning feels. That shit's addicting. So I'm sure he's like trying to chase the next title.
Yeah, it's got to be a great feeling that he's like, okay, if I can do this, then maybe I can sneak a couple more out before I retire. So, yeah.
I mean, as long as his body's holding up, I don't see why not. 100%. Actually, it's the family thing too, right?
Yeah, his daughter's growing up. He wants to like spend time with her, I'm pretty sure.
He actually wants to be a part of her life. That's
yeah, 100%.
Good dad.
Yeah. But moving on to an interestingly named European Open, which was in Antwerp. I think that's kind of just a hilarious name for a tournament just because they're like, okay, this one's the European Open. It's all of Europe. I'm like, you couldn't just name it like the Antwerp Open, or is there another Antwerp Open that already took that title? Like, come on.
Well, Antwerp's in Belgium, right?
Yeah.
So the European Union capital is in Belgium. I think it's in Brussels.
Okay.
So it kind of makes sense why they call it the European Open.
But
I feel like it should be in Brussels, not Antwerp.
Yeah, or they call it the Antwerp Open. Like, they had the Stockholm Open. Like, why call it the European Open? Just
I know.
The Stockholm Open is also a European Open.
You should email ATP again.
Exactly. Just be like, change the name of this tournament. It doesn't make any sense.
Hey, if anyone knows, feel free to drop a comment.
Exactly, yeah. But speaking on this tournament, there were nearly two super young winners in 1 week with Field obviously making the final playing Bublik. Field beat Tsitsipas, really close semifinal matchup, and actually making this final gets his ranking up to number 38, and he will be competing in the next gen finals this year. So I think that'll be cool to see. We'll be seeing people like him, Shelton, playing in these next gen finals. Actually,
yeah,
Shelton could play in the ATP finals still if he has a crazy last couple tournaments. Like if he wins Paris, he could still be in contention for that. But in all likelihood, he's probably going to be in the next gen finals. But what did you think of Field's performance in the European Open?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think he played great. I've kind of been hit or miss on him because, you know, same kind of deal where you see a lot of like, oh, wow, this guy's really good. Never really expected him to make a title or be a finalist. So he exceeded my expectations there. And with someone like Bublik, he's also another kind of guy where I didn't really expect him either. So I was
like a Karatsev.
Yeah. He's the dark horse, you know?
Yeah. Every once in a while he shows up and you're like, dude, this guy's insane. And but then you're like, oh, and then he's gone.
Yeah. And he's an entertainer too. Bublik.
Yeah.
What is his game? What is so special about it?
I think he's kind of a little bit of a junk baller, but he also has a really strong serve that helps him out a lot. So I think it's just a mix up game that he plays.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I think that's why he was able to beat Rublev and Hall. And I think it's because Rublev plays like that very stereotypical, like, I'm going to just pound the ball from the baseline game. And Bublik just kind of played a bunch of weird shots that Rublev isn't necessarily used to playing against. And so Bublik was able to kind of mess with his rhythm a little bit. So I think that's kind of what he's able to do to top guys every once in a while.
Yeah, for sure.
But speaking on this tournament, I just talked about how Tsitsipas lost to Thiel, still got 90 points from the tournament. Was this a smart tactical play? Because obviously he could have played in Stockholm. He could have played in Tokyo, and he decided to go to Antwerp. And it's interesting because 90 points is the same as someone like Tommy Paul, who also had to get two wins. But I think he probably had to do it over a little bit more difficult opponents than Tsitsipas ended up having to play.
Yeah, I think it definitely is a strategic play. This is what I alluded to before in the beginning of the podcast with FAA. I think for someone like Tsitsipas, if you're struggling, you have to keep getting those little wins and stack them up. So he went in there and, you know, he could have won a final. He was the semifinalist. So I think for him, he picked the tournament that he had the best chance to win. And hey, even if he didn't win the final, he made it to the semifinals. So that's a positive. That's something good rather than losing first or second round in Tokyo. I think it's, you know, the 90 points helps not only with his ranking, but I think the semifinal placing also gives him the confidence too.
100%. It was a close match with Thiel, and he would have been favored going into that final against Bublik. So he could have very easily won the tournament, didn't end up going his way. But yeah, it seems like it was a smart tactical play to go to Antwerp.
I wonder how often they do three tournaments at the same time, because you get, I think I said this last week too, you get just more talent spread out, which I guess is good for the lower ranked players like Fiat Bublik, who actually have chances to make a final, but it's not as entertaining as a fan to watch because you don't get those big heavyweight matchups.
You don't get those heavyweight matchups, but yeah, I think sometimes people want to see that little bit of a mix up where they're seeing someone like Monfi played, I think, Kotov in the final, who was a qualifier in the tournament. And you wouldn't see that really in Tokyo because he'd probably lose in an early round.
Yeah, plenty of tennis to go around. You got to share the love.
Exactly. Just the last thing about that tournament, Bublik, after he won the title, I think it is kind of funny because he made this comment about, oh, I'm so glad that I was able to play you and beat you before Fee blows up and becomes the next big thing. He's like, yeah, I just kind of got lucky. And I kind of think it reflects Bublik's personality, kind of like I was talking about. I think that's kind of the story of this week, is some players are just opportunists, and whether it's Karatsev, whether it's Monfi, they see their chance and they seize it. And Bublik saw his chance, seized it, got this tournament win. And then I have no idea how he'll do in Paris, but you don't really expect that much from him.
Yeah, no, exactly. What a classy guy. See, he keeps you entertained, not only on the court, but off the court too. 100%. I love when he like says stuff like that. It's pretty funny. But that's kind of like what I said before too, kind of for people who play great players on their back end, where it's like, oh, I beat Roger Federer. Like Hurkacz beat Roger Federer, but you know, Ferrer never beat Federer in his whole life. Exactly. So this is kind of something you kind of get on the front end too. So Bublik, if Field does blow up, he can say, I beat Field.
Yeah, in 2 years, someone's going to be like, oh, I beat Djokovic. And Monfils going to be like, God damn it. Yeah.
Exactly. Maybe that's when he'll retire.
Yeah, exactly. When other people start beating Djokovic and he can't still.
Or when he beats him.
Yeah, I think that's less
likely. Maybe he just, dude, because I don't know, both those guys, I do think Djokovic is in better physical shape.
When Djokovic is 39 and Monfi is 40, I don't think Monfi is going to have the advantage.
Oh, poor guy.
Yeah, exactly.
What's coming up this week?
Yeah, this week we got another doubleheader. Actually, could be arguable it's a more intense doubleheader because it's two ATP 500 tournaments this week. We got Vienna and then the Swiss indoors. This is an interesting week because FAA has to defend his title to stay near the top, because he's already dropped to number 27 in the live rankings because he won the Swiss indoors last year. And this is the start of his run where he won three tournaments in a row last year. So he's got to do something to defend his spot, or he's just going to disappear back into the mid 50s.
Yeah, that's a crazy stat. You're getting me excited here. I'm feeling good for FAA.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. All right, are you ready to hop into segments?
Yeah, let's do it. What is new in tennis?
The article I saw this week was about Djokovic, and he's been supporting this other Serbian player, Hamad Medvedevic, who's currently number 102 in the world. Actually has a losing record on the tour, but Djokovic is kind of supporting him and like helping him get to tournaments and stuff like that. And I think it's cool to see because obviously Djokovic has the money to support him, and he's supporting another countryman, and it's a good thing to do, I think. And I think it would be cool to see other guys do this because they could, and it's just kind of supporting the tour and allowing younger guys to come up. But I think it is also kind of funny because if Medvedevic does get better and does all of a sudden break into the top 100 next year, what if he's playing against Djokovic? And then there's almost like a tampering situation where you're like, even if Djokovic says, hey, play your as hard as you can against me, the tour is like, yeah, but you're paying him. That can't be okay.
Yeah. No, that's good. I like to see that too, and I wish there was more of that. But I'm curious to see if Djokovic has like equity or stake in his career, where he's like, it's kind of a...
I think it's more like a charity situation rather than an investment situation.
Because what if people start investing in players? I mean, I'm sure it happens, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of what sponsors already do.
Yeah.
It's like...
Yeah.
You sponsor a player and you hope that your investment in them and buying them all this stuff and paying them ends up promoting your brand enough that it compensates.
Right. Well, speaking of Djokovic's finances, my What's New in Tennis is article ATP Finals winner could earn the biggest check in tennis history because it offers the biggest prize money yet. And Djokovic won this last year, which was a record then. And this year's amount is $4,411,500.
Jeez. Yeah, that's pretty wild. I mean, $4 million for one tournament. I don't know what you get for winning a Grand Slam, but I would assume it's pretty comparable to that. And this is just like, oh, you're one of eight guys. So if you can beat these other seven guys, then like you're going to win $4 million. Pretty insane to think about.
Oh, yeah.
Let's hop into bet of the week. So who are you taking this week?
So this week I am taking Jari plus 115 over.
Ooh, the Jari train is back.
The Jari train is back and it is chugging at full force. But I feel like Vegas is trying to tease me here by giving Jari positive odds because they know I'm going to jump all over that. Come on.
Yeah.
It's Nicholas Jari. But Mannarino is, you know, he's a little... freaking, he's not easy, and he just won a title too.
Yeah, and I mean, I think he's won a couple of titles this year, so he's playing a pretty high level, which is pretty cool to see since Mannarino's not a young buck, but he's playing at some of the highest level that he ever has.
Yeah, I know. And what I think is going to happen here is I think it's going to be tough for Jari. I think he's going to play aggressive, but I think Mannarino is going to, you know, be the wall that he is and put everything back. So I'm thinking Mannarino wins, takes the first set, and then the second set, Jari plays even more aggressive, takes more chances, and I think those start to pay off, and then he just clutches up in the third. It's kind of what I'm going for.
A cool prediction. Well, I guess we'll see, but
yeah,
could be a pretty exciting match.
Exactly. Anytime I see Jari with positive odds, I'm pretty tempted to take it. Because it's tempting because it's Mannarino. If it was Jari against, I don't know, Alcaraz, positive odds, obviously I'm not going to take that. But who are you taking?
I'm taking Bublik plus 140 over Ruud. I feel like this is just a classic bet for me because I'm going with that momentum. Bublik just got that big tournament win. And Ruud has been, I mean, not bad, but kind of mediocre recently, I'd say. And I think that's a little bit reflected in the odds because I think usually Bublik wouldn't be as close as plus 140, but even though the line is pretty close, I think that the value is there to go for Bublik in this matchup.
I really like that bet. I'm going to take that one too. I also think Ruud's going to have a hard time against Bublik just because Bublik is the type of player that, you know, is very distracting when you play him. And Rude is that stoic, like no emotion, come on, let's just play tennis type of guy, like no BS.
Yeah.
So I think Bubic has the chance to kind of get in his head and throw him off.
Would not be a good situation for Rude to be in, I don't think.
Yeah, I know.
It's like when Kyrgios gets in your head.
Oh man, dude, I know. But yeah, first week I've in a while that I didn't choose a little lock parlay. Dude, the one last week, I parlayed Rude. And then in the middle of this LA Chargers Cowboys game, I was like, yeah, let me add LA on to sweeten up, juicing up the odds. And of course, that's the first one of the whole leg. So the first leg is blown. And then the rest of the parlay hits.
Oh, no. You're like, oh, this is done. And then you just see green, green, green. Yep. Like everything's working.
Yep.
All righty, you want to hop into match of the week?
Yeah, let's do it. So mine is the Demon Deminar. Comeback win against Draper. What was it 4-6, 7-6, 7-6? I think this match just exemplifies how scrappy and resilient Deminar is. And that's why I love watching him play. This dude is just all over the court, does not give up on anything. And even though Draper's big guy has a big serve, Deminar is able to kind of like, all right, not take care of the first set, but then getting the two tiebreakers in the next two sets kind of makes you wonder, you know, should this have been an easier match for Deminar? I know Draper's good, but I feel like Deminar is a way better player than he is. And I feel like he should have had an easier time. What do you think?
I think that Deminar is maybe the type of guy that in a close match like this, sometimes he's able to get it done, even if he's not having his best day.
Yeah. Like I said, just scrappy, resilient player.
Exactly.
This is a little off topic, but did you see that video of Jack Draper and Andy Murray driving in a car?
Oh, yeah.
Drunk, yeah. Listening to that song.
Well, Draper was drunk. I don't think Murray was because he was driving.
True. Yeah, true. But you see him give the bird?
Yeah, Draper just like has the camera on him and Murray's like, dude, just get that out of my face.
Dude, I love to see that. Tennis players having fun. That made my day. I watched it probably 50 times.
Yeah. So it was a good video.
All right, who was your match of the week?
Yeah, my match of the week was another comeback, Shelton against Giron, 6-7, 7-6, 6-4. This match was just incredible. So Shelton was up a break in that first set and was actually serving for the set. And Giron broke back and then took that first set in a tiebreak. So if we're talking about momentum, Giron takes all the momentum from that first set into the second set. And it showed. Giron ended up going up two breaks in the second set and has all the momentum, is up 5-2, serving for the match. And Shelton displayed some sort of supernatural mentality and just breaks back at 5-2, holds, breaks again at 5-4, takes it to a tiebreaker, and then wins it in a tiebreaker, that second set. And now all of a sudden, he has the momentum. And gets up a break in the third set there. And even though Giron actually had a break point at 4-5, there was actually a really cool point where Shelton kind of got stuck at the net in one of those situations where you're like, the other guy has a pot shot essentially, and Giron just smashes the ball and Shelton just has a great reaction volley and just gets it back and pushes it past him and then ends up taking it 6-4 in that third set. So really an exciting match. I would recommend going back, watching those highlights because very entertaining.
Wow, that's insane. I knew Ben had good hands, but geez, like that.
Yeah, very
cool. I also realized this tournament that Ben is very, very hard to lob because he is aggressive. He does get to the net a lot. And this is another thing I wanted to ask you. What do you think about your percentage of trying to lob him versus try to pass him? I feel like if you don't have a perfect lob, which is very hard to do, you're just getting the ball smashed in your face.
Yeah, I think Shelton is very good at dealing with lobs. I think it helps that he has such a strong serve. I think that obviously transitions to having a great overhead. I think if you have a decent passing shot, you should probably go for that. But I think Shelton's overall pretty strong at the net. So I think you're in a tough situation either way.
Yeah. All right, and that's the show. If you're not already subscribed, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube at Painting Lines Podcast. Feel free to shoot us a DM or email us any questions or thoughts at paintinglinespodcast@gmail.com.